It's here and now. 60 years ago tomorrow, the Supreme Court ruled separate public schools for blacks and whites were unconstitutional, even if they were equal. Today, two women, one white, one black, friends, who grew up in the segregated South and now are educators trying to realize that decision's promise. In 2007, the Supreme Court said schools no longer had to strike a racial balance through school assignments, and many have resegregated. Cindy Chance is the dean of the College of Education at Georgia Regents University. She's white and went to school in impoverished rural Tennessee. Vivian Gunn Morris is a professor and associate dean at the University of Memphis. She went to segregated black schools. And Vivian, you first. In the 50s, did you even know you were in a segregated school?
Well, for me, that's just the way it was. You know, you had white schools on one side of town, and you had black schools on my side of town.
Same with me. The white school was several miles from my home when, in fact, I could almost see the black school from my house. But instead, I was on the bus going to the white school. I lived in what was considered the bottom, and there were only sharecroppers down there, a few white families, mostly black families, that were sharecroppers. And we all grew up together. We all worked together. We all had hog killings together. But when it came time to go to church or when it came time to go to school, it was segregated.
Well, and Vivian, how about you? I understand that you were in an all-black school in Tuscumbia,
yes.
But it was a model school. It was a good school.
At that time, we did not feel that we were being deprived of a good education because we had very good teachers. But the thing that we knew that we were being deprived of was adequate facilities, buildings, you know, physical facilities, and materials and supplies. But in some ways, that was made up by the PTA that raised money to buy some of those extra things.
Well, there was a divide between the white and the black schools. And Cindy, you were confronted with a further divide between the more well-off white schools and the poor white schools.
That is correct. The building that I attended was a three-teacher school with multiple grades in one classroom, no running water, no indoor plumbing, no cafeteria. But there again, as Vivian said, the parents felt ownership of that school. It was their community school. They felt ownership. They were willing to do whatever it took in order to get the best education for their children because they really believed that education was the only thing that could move their children up in the social status as well as economic status.
Well, let's fast forward because Brown v. Board took one or two decades to actually implement. You were long gone from school when that happened. There was tremendous resistance, busing, white flight from inner city schools. And slowly, many schools began resegregating to the point that today, children, according to research from Rutgers University, are more isolated from different peers than ever. Their parents may be working together, but they're not going to school together. Some analysts say this is an issue of housing. Until you have more affordable housing that can integrate communities, you're not going to integrate schools. But let's take up the idea of resegregation. And Vivian, would you start with something you say you're seeing, kids self-segregating or being segregated within schools?
In many schools today, often what you have is two schools, more white students in your gifted programs and more of your African-American students who are really being misdiagnosed and put into special ed very often because of behavioral problems.
I think it's resegregation, but I also think it's socioeconomic because you'll also find a lot of poor children, whether they're Hispanic, black, white. And I think that goes to show that you can't legislate morality. The legislation had a good intent, but you can't legislate people who are sensitive to other people's needs, really trying to make the social changes take place at the same time we're looking at educational changes. And there are very, very successful African-American kids, successful school systems with middle-income and upper-income African-Americans. I think a lot of the problems goes back to the lack of jobs. Parents, when they don't have the resources to support their children, whether it's African-Americans or poor whites, are holding down two and three jobs so they don't have time to help their children to do the things that middle and upper income families have time. They don't always have the money for computers and other kinds of things. And if you look at the countries that outscore America, for example, Finland, they evaluate children and parents and their ability to support their children in education on the day that the child is born. And for those parents that need the support, it starts then. we would probably call that socialism.
Well, Vivian, we've touched on resegregation within schools, but address resegregation of schools.
We know, and you've talked about the white flight, people going to private and parochial schools, and now charter schools. So many of the families who are doing very well, who have a lot of power and clout in schools, are not in those segregated schools that you're talking about. Mm. So what we have very often are teachers who are not certified in the schools where you have a large number of African-American students. You have the poor facilities just like pre-Brown. And also, you're having a focus on standardized tests, and the students are not in these schools are being prepared and focused on reading and math, and the arts are left completely out. So we know that the arts and sports and other things like that help to keep kids in school.
Well, what to do? There are some busing programs that are embraced by minorities, but largely people don't want their kids to leave the communities. If people are either self-segregating in communities or being forced into communities that they can afford, and that's leading to segregated schools, what's the solution?
I think the first prong is dealing with some social problems that have not been dealt with. We've had equal housing bills and legislation that has not been enforced. We've had opportunities for young people to choose other kinds of schools like magnet schools and those kinds of things. But in many cases, it's been unavailable to minority kids because of lack of transportation or some of the financial reasons. I think another thing that we have not dealt with very well, and I think it's looming over us now, and that is the ability of our students to culturally commute, whether they're culturally commuting from one social and racial community to another, or whether they're commuting globally. And if our students, our young people, are going to be competitive in a global society, they have to be able to understand different cultures and culturally commute. I think we've proved beyond a shadow of doubt that mandated busing is probably not the best answer. So I think we're going to have to look for some other solutions.
It's going to take policymakers at every level who are committed to making a change in what's happening in our country.
That's Vivian Gunn-Morris, Professor of Education and Associate Dean in the Department of Education, Health, and Human Science at the University of Memphis. She's also co-author of The Price They Pay, Desegregation in an African-American Community. Professor Morris, thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Cindy Chance is the Dean of the College of Education at Georgia Regents University. Dean Chance, Dr. Chance, thank you as well.
You're very welcome.
And in the coming weeks, we'll have more on the fallout of resegregated schools. Will society at large become more segregated? We'll also look at new policies and ways schools and parents are trying to reintegrate schools, including one district making sure there's a balance of family incomes in classes. You're listening to Here and Now.